Michael Harrison here for Talkers. Last week, shortly after the Democratic presidential TV debate sponsored by CNN and the New York Times, I had the opportunity to engage in an interesting phone conversation with one of the candidates who didn't qualify for the last two events, but whom I find to be extremely colorful and compelling. Not so much that I'm politically endorsing her. I don't do that sort of thing. And if I did, I don't know if I would endorse her. I'm not even sure she'd make a good or effective president. But I really like her offbeat style, and her message of love, peace, ethics, and morality are always welcome, in my opinion, in any discussion of public policy and politics. I also like the way she's not allowed her disqualification from the big TV stage to dishearten her efforts on the campaign trail, and she remains hopeful that when the actual votes begin being cast in February, her candidacy will be taken more seriously by the media and the Democratic National Committee. She's out there working hard, bringing her message to growing crowds in the early primary states, articulating a detailed platform that addresses every major issue of the day, and doing it with a style that makes her a cool and compelling presenter to witness. I'm talking about Marianne Williamson.
Thank you. Thank you for all of that.
How has the media been treating you? And and the media has been such a big part of this whole political season, obviously, since Trump became president.
Well, I think how I've been treated by the media is plain for all to see. One of the things I've learned, though, is that the media is not a monolith. There are a lot of responsible journalists out there who clearly took ethics classes in journalism. Serious, responsible journalists are skeptical and in a healthy way. It is part of their job to kick the tires. After all, I am running for president. And that, in a way, is a creative process. And that I don't mind. But on the other hand, we're living at a time of journalism by clickbait. Many people who you wonder if, in fact, they did take any ethics classes in journalism school, who don't seem above using somebody's anonymous tweet as a source, who don't feel the need to check facts, who don't feel the need to characterize accurately. And that, of course, has been frustrating. So I have been subject to some pretty merciless smear that has certainly had an effect. The idea of me as wackadoodle crystal lady who is against science or against medicine or crazy or dangerous, I've seen myself. I mean, described in the most outrageous terms, really. And that, of course, is serious in that those political hits are for a reason. They're done for a specific purpose, and that is to create enough suspicion about you, particularly if you are a non-establishment candidate. So people are already asked to be thinking outside the box. But having said that, I also see how certain stories, particularly if they're lies, don't have to hang in the air. And the conversation with the media is exactly that. It's a conversation that is continuing. So how the media treated you yesterday might not be the way the media treated you today, for instance. Even though there have been stories along the line of what I just described, Jonathan Capehart, a very well-established, well-thought-of, opinion writer and editor at the Washington Post, wrote a very glowing article yesterday. And it was one of those articles based on an experience that many have reported. Wow, when I actually met her, when I actually interviewed her, she wasn't who I thought she was. Well, why did they think I was someone else? Because of the media. On the other hand, they're in the media, so they're reporting in the media that I'm not who they thought they were is equally important. So that's been my experience, and I think that we all know the issues of you know, the proverbial corporate media in America. We all know the pitfalls, the perils, but also the necessity and the possibilities and the value of a free press.
The debate situation, I have to tell you, you were missed in the last debate. You bring a certain element to it that's very refreshing. I get the feeling watching this debate format that it's like watching an old or actually a new Jeopardy show or a game show, but particularly Jeopardy, with except four people on a panel. You have 12 now. And in many ways, it has the feeling of a game show. It's very the line between entertainment and real news has been very blurred. You've been on both sides of it now. I guess it. Did you watch the debate this week? I guess that's the first question.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. It's
personally
like
frustrating.
Well, it's like bad high school theater. It's the DNC and the corporate media have created their own reality show empire, and it's based on something very nefarious. It's the effort on the part of the DNC to narrow the debate at a time when actually we should be expanding it. The only thing that should be, quote unquote, narrowing down the candidates is the voters. That's what primary elections are about. That's what the primaries are for. So the way the DNC has gone about, through polling, through money, through all of the various ways that it has of selecting its own, put its finger on the scale, is very undemocratic. You know, last time it was, it has to be Hillary. And this time they're basically saying that it has to be one of these six. So it's unfortunate, because what it has created is a situation that is inauthentic, which is narrow, which is superficial, which mitigates against the kind of deep thinking, deep inquiry, deep reflection that should be at the core of our politics, particularly at this critical time in our history. So I believe that the DNC and the media should be facilitating democracy, not dictating democracy.
Well, and you're right. I'm going to jump in. You make a very good point. We must keep in mind that these debates are being run by the media and the networks. They're basically television shows. This week's The New York Times
that's
was involved.
All that they are.
But they're TV shows. What are your hopes and what are your expectations when it comes to when the votes start being cast? Obviously, this has got to be in your mind, you know, that not one vote has been cast yet. And we talk about this as if they're
exactly.
So what are your hopes and what are your expectations?
Well, there are two political universes. One is the pundits and the debates and the DNC and the polls and the money and all of that. And then there's another political universe, and that's actual democracy. That's the mind of the voter. That's the actual communication that exists between candidates and voters. And one of the things that's very profound and also very moving about the process is that when you are in Iowa, you're in South Carolina, you're in New Hampshire, you're in Nevada, and also California now, although I don't sense that Californians have really grokked this yet. Not every Californian really understands yet. Mm. It doesn't seem, because this is a new phenomenon. The voters in those states know that they are the deciders. They know that MSNBC is not the decider. They know that Fox News, CNN, DNC are not the deciders. And they take this process very seriously. So what I'm trying to do, which is difficult because I do not have the money that the establishment candidates have, and I do not have the establishment power that the other candidates have, and now because of the DNC's rules, I'm not on the debate stage at the moment, but I hope that that will change. Perhaps I can get in for the fifth one. I certainly hope so. But in the meantime, people are continuing to come to my talks. My crowds are growing. The money is still coming in that enables me to do this. And my interest is in talking to the American people, particularly in those primary states, about my vision for America, the new chapter, the new beginning that's both needed and possible, how we have to end an aberrational chapter in our history, dig deep inside ourselves for the kind of wisdom that is needed to truly change this country from the inside out, and move into a place where, instead of allowing short-term profit for multinational corporations to be our organizing principle, we return to what this country should be, where real democracy and humanitarian principle guides us collectively as much as we seek to have conscience and goodness guide us individually. Mm. And that will mean looking at public policy, and if I'm president, making all public policy based on one core principle. What would help people thrive? I want to unleash the spirit of the American people. I want to uncap the dreams of the American people, because that's where peace comes from. allow people to dwell in a place where they're not chronically stressed and anxious because of economic anxiety. They're not chronically anxious and stressed, worrying about what will happen if they get sick or one of their children gets sick. They're not chronically anxious and upset because they don't know how their kids will go to college. They don't know how they'll get out from under these college loans. Let people exist in a state where they can more easily spread their wings, actualize their own potential. That unleashes the creativity and the productivity of the American people. That's where our prosperity comes from, and that's where peace comes from, both domestically and internationally. That's a real shift in core organizing principle. My goal is to offer that vision, offer the policies that align with that vision, offer that possibility to the American people. That, and then the rest is in their hands. That's where it belongs. But if I can move into that primary season, when those votes start in February, knowing that the people in those states know that this vision is an option, have gotten to know me well enough to have a sense of who I am as a woman and how I would actually cause those changes, then I will be perfectly satisfied that the decision made by the American people will be the one that is to be trusted.
Hmm. Now, you know, there never is an end to this. This is an ongoing process, and one campaign leads to the next. You're a prolific author. I believe you've had about 13 bestsellers, books. Am I correct?
Well, I've had 13 books, but 7 bestsellers.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, that's that ain't chopped liver. And I'm sure there'll be more books. And the way I see you, your voice is not dependent on whether you get elected president. There is nothing saying that you just cannot continue to have a voice out there. As a matter of fact, if I may be so bold as to say, you might be better off not being president. But that's neither here nor there, and it's not for me to say, but I said it. But I mean, you are a voice in this country. And you have had a following for years. As a matter of fact, I would imagine the core of your campaign has been built on your fans who have followed you through your literature and through your speeches and the work that you've done in many arenas of the human condition. So I'd imagine that would go on. Is there a part of you that sees that at this point, that you're in the thick of it, that this campaign is just another step in a longer journey that you're on in terms of spreading your inspiration and your opinions and your views and your view of the world as a citizen who happens to be blessed with the ability to communicate? It's not only about winning or losing this presidency, is it?
Well, every experience in life leads to the next experience, and every experience is part of the longer journey of life. I certainly understand that. Is it a good thing that I can have a voice that will allow me to speak to more people about the need to feed 13 million hungry children? Yes, but that's not nearly as good as actually having the levers of power at your command to make sure that those children get fed. So if it's just about elevating the conversation, I've sort of been doing that for many years. That's what being an author is. But when you run for president, you're actually running for the opportunity to appoint the head of the EPA, to appoint the Secretary of State, to appoint the Attorney General, to actually cultivate and submit the legislations and submit the budget that would actually align in a very practical way with the ideas that you're discussing. There's no guarantee for any candidate that they're going to win, and no candidate, therefore, knows for sure that they will.
Yeah, but, nobody does. That's true. That's true.
Yeah, but I also feel if you're doing something this serious, and running for president is very serious, people are sending you money. People are spending their time. You don't mess with people's thoughts and feelings. It's something about this important, particularly when Donald Trump is president. So I owe it not only to myself, I owe it to my country, and I owe it to everybody who's even entertaining the thought of possibly giving me their vote next year to be deeply serious about this. And not thinking in terms of a plan B, but thinking in terms of whatever I can do to make this campaign the fullest expression of a very real political possibility and to prepare myself in case I win.
And if you do win, and you're already in it, How do you find the nuts and bolts of doing politics? Politics is such a cutthroat, dirty business. You seem to be somebody who would find a lot of it to be distasteful. How do you reconcile that in terms of your own nature? And if you were to become president and you see what goes on out there in terms of the mudslinging, the insults, the attacks, as you've already experienced at the beginning of this conversation, how are you reconciling that in your mind?
It is distasteful. But memo to Earth, Donald Trump is president. The American Revolution was distasteful. It had to be fought. Mm-hmm. World War II was distasteful, but it had to be fought. Desegregating the American South was painful and difficult, but the civil rights movement needed to happen. The women's suffrage movement, of course, caused a lot of strain, a lot of stress, a lot of pain for many women, but it was worth doing. Abolition, this wasn't an easy thing to do, to be an abolitionist. You know, our generation is too precious. Our generation needs some courage. Some things you do in life, not because they're the easy thing to do, not because they're the convenient thing to do, not because they're the comfortable or fun thing to do, but because they're the thing that needs to be done. And that's how I see this. You know, I'm very aware, particularly as a woman, I say things about my government on this campaign, which in some countries, particularly saying things about my government the way I do as a woman, I would probably be hauled to jail. Very possibly tortured, or even worse. So I'm not interested in that kind of preciousness and entitlement that has made too many Americans think about what feels good before what needs to be done.
Switching gears quickly, I want to compliment you on that elevator pitch video that I saw. I don't know. I don't know if it went 90 seconds or 2 minutes, or I don't know quite how long it was. I watched it three times and didn't time it.
Oh, thank you.
But I've used it as an example for people who as excellent writing and excellent presentation. Was that your idea?
Thank
Did somebody
you.
Come up with it? For those listening,
no, that's Yahoo. It was when I went over to Yahoo News that day. Actually, I had an interview. Their finance. It was lovely people in their finance department. Yeah, that was Yahoo News. I think that's just, you know, they just say walk into the elevator. You know, I was just following directions.
You mean you did that off the top of your order. You did that off the top of your head?
Well, remember now, you're running for president, you were basically rehearsing all day. Every
I sound
day.
So naive, don't
you know?
I?
It's like you and I have not exactly talked about anything today that I haven't already talked about at some point.
Yeah,
so
I know.
That's, you know, that's part of running.
Well, you understand. For somebody like me right now interviewing you in this particular dance, the last thing I want is for you to do a canned speech. And on the other hand, I owe you the respect to give you a chance to get your message out.
It's a big both and there, because if all you're doing is repeating what you said yesterday verbatim, it is canned and it is dead and it is boring. And I don't know how I could stand it any more than you could. Life isn't like that. If something's not emerging from you fresh and heartfelt in that moment, then you're certainly not having fun and you're certainly not reaching anyone else.
What have you learned? What have you learned from this experience? And how are you different today than maybe a year ago as a result of running for president?
I've learned that the system is even more corrupt than I feared. And the people of the United States are even more wonderful than I hoped.
And there you have a conversation I had with presidential candidate Marianne Williamson. She might not be elected president in November of 2020, but she sure is a big-time author, public speaker, and major league spokesperson for a school of thought that will most likely grow as we continue deeper into the 21st century. In other words, I think she's a hell of a compelling talk media personality worthy of special attention by our industry. For Talkers, I'm Michael Harrison.